Okay, everybody, welcome back to Film Buffs. Today, we're going to take it back, way back, to 1942 with Casablanca. I'm joined with Alex and Jono today. Say hi, everybody.
Hi.
How's everyone doing today?
Pretty good.
I too.
In quarantine.
I'm good in quarantine.
That's good.
Well, not quarantine. We're self-isolating. Quarantine says that we're all healthy. We're all happy.
At least that's true. So. None of us are carriers of this thing.
Yeah.
I don't know, man.
At least for now.
You never know.
So, Casablanca. Jono, had you seen this film before?
No, I don't think I've seen it in its entirety. No. I can't say it. I've read a lot about it.
I think everybody knows about it. But Alex, why did you want to do this film? We had a bit of a discussion about this during the week. So why did we pick a nice old film?
Well, we were talking about how people nowadays think that there's no films before 2000. Really. Like, people think that there's no movies before that. And classic Hollywood is beautiful, and Casablanca is one of my favorite classic films of all time. It's a really beautiful movie.
It is. It's a great film, and it's. I always get frustrated when people say, "Oh, it's an old film," and there's this kind of derogatory implication with it, where it's like anything that's old is not good anymore, or it's boring, or it's black and white, and I don't want to watch it because it's not in color. And those kind of things really frustrate me because there's so much value to watching old films like this, especially as a student of film, even as an audience member, I think. So, Jono, as a first-time viewer all the way through, what did you think of the film?
I was pleasantly surprised, and I guess it does. I felt not so surprised as well. I was like, well, there's a reason why this is a classic. Mm-hmm. I actually really enjoyed it. I would say I was more engaged in this film than I have been in more recent films. Like, I gotta be honest, guys. Like, I get really easily distracted watching a movie, especially at home.
Yeah.
And this one I quite enjoyed.
Yeah, it's a very engaging film. I freaking love it.
Yeah, me too. It's great storytelling, really. It's timeless. It's been, when did it came out, 1942?
Yeah, 1942 was the, I think it was November 1942 was its initial release.
It's still relevant, right?
Absolutely, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, like,
yeah,
everything
for sure.
In it, there's subjects treating the movie that are completely, that they could be put in a movie today and it will still make sense, you know.
Yeah.
Well, it was definitely it captured your attention because and that's the cool thing. I mean, it surprised me and it didn't. It's a classic for a reason, but it surprised me in the sense that, yeah, I kind of went into this like thinking exactly what Dan said, which is this is an old movie. It's black and white. It's probably going to be irrelevant in some way, or it's going to feel a little dated. But I immediately, like within the first 10 minutes, was like, yeah, no, this is actually interesting. Like it's hooked me. Its characters are interesting. And that is totally a result of good writing. And Robert McKee, I mentioned his book. He actually uses this film quite a bit. I don't think he actually really references many films. I don't know. I can't remember when Story was published by Robert McKee, but he references mostly classic films like Through a Glass Darkly and Casablanca and Chinatown. Like,
mm-hmm.
like obviously they span a variety of decades, but I mean, a lot of them are old classic films. And again, they're classics for a reason because they're well-structured, they're well-written, and they're well thought out.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So where would you guys like to start with this? Because I've got a lot of thoughts and I just wondered what stuck out to you?
Jono? It's the first time you've seen it.
Well, obviously, Rick, the character Rick, obviously stands out to me in his. The reason why he's so interesting is because he's just so, he seems so static. He's just like, he doesn't care about anything except himself. Like, he's just this very, just, you know, cynical. Mysterious, but also just kind of like, he's a guy that's in Casablanca, stuck more than anybody, but also, he's also comfortable there, and he thrives in that space for some reason. And you're kind of like, why is this guy doing so well here? Why is he okay with all of this? He's obviously like just completely let go of the cares that most people carry. And he's kind of just found himself in this situation where he's just like, he's unfazable. He's okay with everything, and he just only focuses on himself, and he's basically like indestructible. Authorities don't bother him, like, and the authorities actually like look to him. He's kind of this focal point, but then he's clearly got this Achilles heel, and this past, and that he was much more than that. So I found him to be a really interesting character. And I was actually very, I just enjoyed watching him a lot. I like those types of characters where, like they own the scene very well. And I want to think about something here too, and this may be going too far, but as far as like costume design in a black and white film where there's no color. I was wondering the whole time, like, I wonder if people who plan costume design actually do think about, like, just the contrast of the black and white and what they wear. And he is, in most of the scenes, wearing a white jacket and a black pants, and he's the only person who's really wearing, in focus, black and white. And he just kind of seems like a very black and white character. Right. Like, he's like, I'm this way, that's it, don't care. But he's actually far more dynamic than that. But again, like, I thought that was kind of interesting. Most people are either wearing like an off something that's kind of in the white or in the black.
Mm-hmm.
And he was one of the few main characters that was wearing both, which I thought was kind of interesting.
So to answer your question, you're absolutely right about the costume designers and the production designers. And that's one of the reasons, again, why I get upset when people discard black and white films, because they are very beautifully crafted, because they look at what the color is going to do when it's in black and white, and they look at the textures. And if you as an audience member start to look at like lighting, texture, color, and how all those things are translated into black and white film stock, it actually has a very beautiful and intentional result.
They actually cared about that. And you actually, when you shoot black and white on film, you tend to use like red, green, and blue filters to make certain things pop more than others. It's pretty interesting.
Well, even how they lit Ingrid Bergman's character, like she's like, it's just, I was interesting to see like how much softer and more how much softer she was lit compared to Humphrey Bogart's character. Like he's far more harsh, and she's like just got these kind of like really nice, soft. I don't even know if there's some kind of filter work going on with like the lens or something like that. But she clearly just had a very different lighting.
Yeah, like some glow.
Yeah.
She's always having like this nice rim light.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's the Hollywood 3-point lighting where she's got the backlight right behind her all the time, so it gives her that essentially like angelic glow, which also speaks to her as a character.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think from what I remember is that Rick has very harsh light, which you mentioned, but that gives all of his angles a much sharper and dynamic feature. So he just has that harder edge look, which works very well with Humphrey Bogart's face.
They were going for that film noir look and changing some of the aspects like her. But still, like, the movie has like a really, a really regular, lighting ratio. it's not like really dramatic with the point that everything is too dark. It's just like probably an 8-1, I think.
Yeah, I think at the most it might get a 16-1, like in the night scenes at times, but it's not too bad. Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, over like to answer your question, yeah, I thought every character has just had an interesting thing to add to it. Like Sam, the piano player, just he's kind of this this connection between the two of them, that but this kind of innocent person who's just been dragged into this as well, but also kind of acts as this sounding board for both of them when they're not connected, but also he just kind of he's just kind of this represents this denial of both feelings at the time, right? He's like, I don't remember how to play the song. Like, all he's always like, he says to both of them constantly, I don't remember the song. He's like, you clearly remember the song, but he's just he's kind of just like, they're both denying and not being upfront about their feelings, and like, even with him, like,
yeah, that's really interesting.
He's the same way.
Because he's like represents the willful amnesia and like the desire to forget.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But he's also this like very caring character who just tries to take care of Rick as well. He tries to like, but again, the willful amnesia, he's just trying to get Rick out of the restaurant when he's drinking and get him like, we're going to go drive. We're just going to, he's almost like the...
Yeah.
Just he's almost like that, just that thought on your shoulder. It's just like, I'm gonna get away from here. Like, even the way he talks to Rick is almost like the way you would speak to yourself in your own mind. You're like, I gotta get out of here, just drive. Like,
yeah,
go.
He's kind of an external conscience in the film, right? He works as that like last remnant that is so a part of Rick, but it's trying to pull him out, and it's this constant battle between the two.
But he's also that for Ingrid Bergman's
Ilsa.
Character as well. Yeah, Ilsa, yeah.
Yeah.
So he's just constantly just
although
like
for her, I wonder if it's more of like she is trying to reclaim something, right? So he serves as an external memory, right? And she's trying to get back, whereas Rick is trying to get out.
Right.
Does that make sense? I don't know.
Well,
that's
she's constantly trying to, she speaks more to Sam, like, lovingly and, like, tries to draw the memories out, whereas Rick doesn't really, Sam does more of the talking, I guess, in the Rick relationship, where he's just kind of, like, trying to stop Rick's train of thought and, like, his anger and just, like, reflecting on it. And he's just like, nah, don't even bother talking about it. Let's get out of here as well, right? Like, whereas Isla just, like, keeps softly pestering, like, poking at him. Almost like, yeah, I don't know. It was an interesting character between the two of them. And then even like Captain Louis, like Renault or whatever.
Yeah,
Renault. Yeah, he's he was an interesting character too, because he's kind of like this comic relief, but he's also this really. He has no loyalties whatsoever, and he's just like Rick. He's an opportunist. He has no loyalties like Rick, but Rick also, well, Rick only has loyalty to himself, whereas the captain is like, he just says, he's just like, sweet, whatever anybody comes along, I'll do it. Yeah, cool. And it's interesting too with wardrobe with him. I noticed he's wearing white at first, and then as he gets convinced by the Germans to kind of like come over to their side very quickly, he switches to a black uniform after that. I found that very interesting throughout this film. I was like, wow, I didn't really expect the use of black and white choices and color was interesting. I was like, you see it, but it's just like it's doing so much with so little, which I thought was fascinating.
Well, it is fascinating because you have to think like before sound, which was the jazz singer in what, 1927, I think. They basically, like, film was a visual medium, so you had to build all of these cues visually into your story. So, and that's the same, like, I remember studying 17th century theater. There's, like, a book where you can go, and there's all these poses and gestures that the character would do. So he'd, like, hold his hand in a certain way, and the audience would know that that's what that meant, that particular sign. So it's visually cueing the audience rather than rather than an auditory cue. So it's, right. it's all this whole history is like built into the visual aspect of cinema, and then the sound aspect gets brought in later, which is really fascinating. So
and all of these kind of art forms are well practiced within their mediums by this point. Like they just keep growing and growing. Yeah, that's an interesting thing to observe, because obviously, you're everybody's trying to make the most with what they have as a storytelling element, and that all stems from the same kind of thinking. It's like, well, we can't use sound, so we're going to use visuals. Well, we don't have color, so we're going to use shades. We're going to do this with lighting to make this pop, even though it's in black and white. It was apparent to me because I started noticing it, because we look at these films that we watch today and we see the use of color, but these things do stand out.
Yeah.
Which I thought was absolutely fascinating. And that's a really good point. Yeah. That you'd have all these, like, through necessity of technology limitations, you'd have to kind of just do your best to tell the story visually. And then that comes into the era of sound, and you have all of that practiced. Which is fascinating.
Yeah, so I'll get to Alex in a sec, because I know you haven't said anything well, but recently I was just doing a play, and I built my character around this idea that he was not simple-minded, but there was a simplicity to him as a person, where he didn't stand for he didn't like any sort of BS or showiness. So I built the character visually with the costume so that he was essentially in primary colors. So that, well, obviously primary colors are, you know, they're pure and they stand alone in nature. So I used those, like I had a yellow shirt, a blue sweater, brown pants, and then a bit of red in the tie. So I intentionally did that. Obviously, I don't know that many people would pick up on that, but there was an intentionality to show something visually. I'm communicating visually rather than in addition to everything else that's happening, all the dialogue and performance. So, yeah, those mediums are very intentional.
Yeah.
It's very cool. Well. Yes.
One of the things that I thought was an interesting way to look at the film is that Casablanca is essentially a purgatory. You know, they set it up at the beginning that people come to Casablanca hoping to get out, but then they're there in Casablanca and they wait. And they wait, and they wait, and there's that refrain the whole way through the movie of people constantly stuck there.
They do that. They do that multiple times.
Yeah.
Throughout the film, where they use that, the wait and wait. I think it happens at least maybe one more, maybe two more times where characters just are kind of complaining about the waiting.
Yeah. So that's an intentional motif that lasts throughout the film, and it constantly brings you back to this idea.
Also interesting though that like Rick is he's the most stuck in purgatory, like
absolutely.
Out of it, he can't go. He's been exiled from America, he had to run from France, like he's basically, this is all he's got. He can't go home, he can't go to the place he stayed before, like he's just ended up here and he's stuck, and just his soul has almost been just stripped from him.
Yeah, and I mean, it's more, I think it's more of a self-imposed exile, right? Because they ask him what his nationality is, and he has that great line where he says, I'm a drunkard.
Yeah.
But I think he can go back if he, like, can he not go back to the States if he wants?
No.
He can't?
No.
No, he can't.
Okay, so that's one of those sort of unspoken things, which is, just adds a nice, interesting layer to him, a complexity. But what I like so much about Rick is that he's really an idealist, right? Because you see in his backstory that he fought in all these wars on the losing side, what they said, but that was actually against the fascists, right? When he fought in Spain, it was against the fascists. So he is essentially an idealist, but then through his relationship with Ilsa, his ideal is shattered and he becomes cynical. And I think it's Jordan Peterson talks about it like that. Like everyone essentially has an innocence about them that's idealistic. And then through these situations like heartbreak and stuff, you become cynical. And it's actually better to be cynical than it is to be idealistic. But the next stage past that is wisdom, right? Because now you have the experience brought about by the heartache or whatever, the destruction of the ideal that leads to cynicism. But then the only way back through that is to willingly step into the world again and to engage with it. So the wisdom brings him back to his ideal, essentially.
Right. And that wisdom in practice is essentially what Ilsa gives him the agency to make the decision for her, and he ultimately makes the wise choice for both of them. He thinks for both of them, yep. And he uses wisdom to essentially make the right decision for Victor as well, like, because he sees the value in what he's doing, and that he needs Ilsa, and he basically steps outside of his emotions and his own wants and makes the right choice and willingly chooses to step into that space and take that initiative as well.
Yeah, he chooses the greater good. Mm-hmm. So what I think is really cool also is that Victor comes onto the scene, and Victor, of course, is the ideal. You know, he's the person that everyone hopes and wishes they would be, right? He is who Rick was, but he's also the version that Rick failed to be.
Right.
Right.
He's continued the cause.
He's continued.
And succeeded. Because he even says to him, I don't remember what the preceding line is, but he says, lots of people try, you succeed.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah, exactly. But then there's the
line
where he says, like, one hears a great deal about Rick and Casablanca. And then Rick says, and about Victor Laszlo everywhere. Right, so there's a juxtaposition of local fame versus universal fame. So there's a greater importance that Laszlo carries. So Laszlo arrives, and he's this ideal, and it makes Rick look very selfish and terrible in that. Where am I going with this thought? But then Victor has this amazing effect on people, right? He's constantly inspiring everybody to resist. And it has this knock-on domino effect, right? Like in the bar scene where they play La Marseillaise, which is the French national anthem, versus the Germans. So they overcome the Germans in that sense. And then Rick, obviously, regains his ideal and joins the fight at the end. And then that translates also to Louis. So there's this really cool psychological aspect happening there where the restored ideal and the presence of an ideal is actually making everyone else around him better.
Right. Yeah, it is interesting. Yeah, the juxtaposition between the two characters, but ultimately Rick becomes the greatest good in the end, arguably more so than Victor, because he's more aware of everything that's going on, and he makes an ultimate sacrifice, which Victor wasn't actually able to do. He wasn't able to give up. He even admits it. He would never give Ilsa up.
He stays in France.
He said that he would leave for this, and he actually didn't. Like, he actually wouldn't sacrifice Ilsa for the ideal. But Rick does.
Oh, that's interesting.
But that's like the whole character of Rick. It's made you to believe that he's a selfish man who doesn't care about anyone but himself. But the reality is that he's not. And you can see it throughout the whole movie that he's actually helping everyone. But it's not that obvious till the end.
Yeah.
But the captain does call him out on this, though. Like, the captain sees through him. He says, you're a cynical shell, but you're actually a sentimentalist.
Yeah. Yes. And that's the idealist underneath. Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting.
He's a good person. Really.
Yeah. And that's the thing. That's why...
Like, even when they break his heart, he's still a good person.
Yeah, right. And that's what I mean. Like, that's how everyone is, essentially, right? The idealist, and then that leads to cynicism.
Yeah, and yeah. He builds that cynical shell for himself. Like you literally have, it's an interesting thing, like the show and tell idea of storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
When it's used to actually be contradictory in the writing, that's an interesting thing, because like Rick is, his lines are written to tell you that he's actually a cynical person. He says, yeah. Nothing impresses me. People say that about him. I stick my neck out for nobody. Like, mm-hmm. He constantly is saying all these things, but they're not true, which is, so it's interesting, like from the show and tell kind of like perspective of writing, he's to actually tell the opposite, but show the truth is an interesting storytelling thing that's done very, very well in this.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bit of a, I mean, it's classic, but like it works quite well because you do believe him. He is like cold. He does allow what's his name to get arrested, and basically he's like, yeah, I stick my neck out for nobody, like this guy. And that guy comes up to him, he's like, well, I hope when I get arrested you'll defend me, like blah blah blah, or you'll do more for me. And he's like, that's when he says the line. Mm-hmm. And it's just kind of an interesting thing. And he's like, he is not really sticking his neck out for anybody. He is kind of sticking to that, but it's not really who he is at the same time, which is really it's an enjoyable evolution to watch.
But what's interesting about that moment, though, is that the guy he's not sticking his neck out for killed people, like murdered them on the train.
Right, yeah.
Right, but then he does go out of his way for the innocent people, like the woman who comes to him to get her husband out. What's her name? Remember the young woman who has that scene with him?
Yeah.
And then he helps the husband win at cards.
Right.
Yeah.
Just work.
Did you know that Humphrey Bogart thought that all of his actions in the movie were incredibly stupid, that were not real at all, and he thought the movie was going to be a failure?
Really?
Yeah.
I thought it was really, like, I really enjoyed it. I was so surprised how much I enjoyed it. I was like,
me too.
Even Captain Renault, is that
Renault.
It?
Yeah.
Renault, like, he just, like, that line where he's like, I'm shutting this place down because there's gambling here. I'm
shocked that there's gambling going on here.
He's like, here are your winnings, Captain. Thank you.
It's so great.
It's
and
so
the timing
good.
Is perfect.
It's so
that
good.
Actor, his name's Claude Rains, and I freaking love him. I know it's like that old school theatrical way of performing, but I think that guy is so charismatic and so charming and just so lovable on screen. He's a great actor.
Yeah. But he's like the flattest.
Yeah,
thoroughly enjoy him.
He's like a little bit in love with Rick as well. Like he's like he's talking about like how he's essentially attracted. If he was a woman, you like or he is just attracted to Rick in general.
Yeah.
It was just, he's such an interesting character and like really, really genuinely funny at points.
But that again reflects that sort of domino effect of like the idealist, right? And being drawn to someone who is an ideal, right? Because you see that throughout with that character as well. Part of his arc is going from the neutral cynic, right? Because he's part of Vichy France. And Vichy France at the time was German occupied France that cooperated. They're essentially a puppet state with the Germans. So he goes from that survivalist mentality, just like Rick does, to becoming a freedom fighter at the end of the film. So what I love, and this is another visual cue that they give you, is at the airport scene when he calls and says Major Strauss has been shot, and he's got the bottle of water. It says Vichy water on it.
Yeah.
So the idea there, when he drops it in the garbage, is like, he's saying, screw Vichy. Forget this neutral, non-resistance idea. And then he goes off with Rick and they become freedom fighters again. So that's part of that arc for him as well.
And that was a nice arc for him as well, because you just didn't expect that to happen. Like, it's just a great mark of good storytelling, like the unexpected out of characters, the shifts that happen. Like, I just really enjoyed watching Renault like just evolve like that. Like you kind of hate him, you kind of like him. He's a bit of a kiss ass.
He's slimy
and then he just he sees the right way and goes for it. Like, and yeah, that redemption, that unification between him and Rick is just because you have this, like, he respects Rick. And he clearly doesn't want, he has no ill will for him. And then it's just, but for him to actually take that path and take that shift at the end was just really, it was a very satisfying finish. And that was the thing, like you have all these classic moments, like here's looking at you, kid. Mm-hmm. And then, the big ending with the plane flying off, like, you know, of all these things from Casablanca and you're like, ah, that's right. Yeah. Okay. Totally. But I didn't realize, I always thought it was a very sad ending, but like for me to watch it and then see what happens between Renault and Rick, it's a very satisfying, happy, rewarding ending. I didn't actually expect that.
Yeah, it's the ascent out of purgatory, right? They finally figured it out and they've chosen to stop this self-isolation.
Oh. Wow. That's true. So nice. Oh, I can't wait till we get out of self-isolation, guys. I feel like Rick.
Yeah, I'm stuck in this purgatory.
Yeah, in my apartment.
Tiny apartment.
Tiny, tiny apartments. Well, what else is there to speak about?
The music.
Course, classic.
Boom, the music, beep, 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 beep. Beautiful.
Yeah, like everyone my singing. Knows the music. Like mm-hmm. it's like Star Wars music, in my opinion. Like everybody knows about it. Like people might not have seen Casablanca, but they know the music is from Casablanca.
Yeah,
it's beautiful.
I didn't really know that though. The wind.
No.
Well, I know all the music, and that was like, huh, this is from Casablanca. There were a lot of moments like that for me, which was interesting. Yeah.
Like it's referenced a lot. Like you can, I think The Simpsons reference mm-hmm. it. South Park. Like
everybody has done it.
Yeah.
The end. Yeah. There's a Simpsons episode with the end of Casablanca that I kept coming to mind, and it was Sam on the piano at the airport or something. Yeah. I don't remember what it was. Oh, it was like an alternate ending to Casablanca that they show to the old folks' home. Yeah. The Simpsons has had a greater impact on my life through classic film.
That's so funny. I've been rewatching The Simpsons because they're on Disney Plus right now. And this is what I mean, right? You see the influence of these films and how big of a deal they are, right? Because everyone is constantly referencing them. So, you know, we watched all those things as a kid and had no idea what it was. But now you watch it and you see here's a annoying technical term, but like, and it's from literature, but the intertextuality, like the interplay between the medium, right? The reference.
That's why I love The Simpsons. Like I remember wanting to watch One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest because I saw a reference to it.
I asked
my uncle, like, what movie is that? Oh, it's called One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Let's go to Blockbuster.
Yeah.
And get it. Yeah, it's cool. Like The Simpsons really brought up that like research part on me of watching more movies. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I watched the one recently where they do the Indiana Jones, the temple, or the boulder chase where Bart runs in and steals the jar.
Yeah, he's stealing the jar.
Love that. I remember seeing that as a kid, and obviously I knew the reference, but I was so excited that The Simpsons did that.
Yeah, they did a lot of references.
Yeah, but it's cool because it's tapping into this broader culture of film and TV history.
Yeah.
Speaking of legacy of this film, one of the things that I find really interesting is the reveal of Rick at the beginning. You kind of hear all about him. People have been talking about Rick, but you haven't seen him yet. And then the first time you see him, you see his hands and a glass of whiskey and the cards, and then you hear his voice first. And then you see him in the white dinner jacket with the red carnation in the lapel. And he has his first line, and I forget what that is. But if you go and watch...
I'm Rick.
Yeah. Hey, I'm Rick.
Hello. Hi, Hello. Sweet cakes. I'm Rick.
I'm Humphrey Bogart, and I don't open my mouth when I talk.
Yeah.
but if you go and you watch James Bond, Dr. No, they build Sean Connery's entrance in his first line of Bond, James Bond, the exact same way. They're actually referencing Casablanca in, this was 1962, so 20 years later. They do the same thing, yeah. So in Dr. No, obviously, he's sitting at the card table playing Baccarat, and he has a bit of a interplay with the lady. You see the hands, and then you see the card table, and then you get the slow push in with him with the cigarette in his mouth, and it says Bond, James Bond. And that is a direct reference to how they built Rick, which is really cool.
Right. So what was it? Was it because like it was just so like the film just existed within the time and really captured the zeitgeist, like in everybody, it was just so relatable to the time. Is that why it became such a classic, I guess, because of, you said it was 1942.
Yeah.
In the midst of everything, I guess America just entered the war, probably not a few months before that.
Yeah, it was about a year before, right? Because it was released in, I know they started filming in May 1942, and Pearl Harbor was December 7th, 1941.
That's right.
So they'd been involved for a while, but I know it wasn't originally like
it was
accepted
filmed
as, like,
and released in the same year?
Yeah. Yeah, it was all done on the Hollywood backlot. I think the only scene that they shot off of the backlot was at Van Nuys Airport.
That was another interesting part about it, is like how small, like I noticed how few locations. Obviously, they mostly shoot at Rick's Cafe.
Yeah. Well, it's built. The story America, is taken from a play called Everybody Goes to Rick's, or Everybody Comes to Rick's, which again is the line in from the movie. So it has that structure of the play being, you know, one or two locations, which is, I don't know. Doing a lot with a little, exactly. You don't need a lot of locations to make a great film.
I just watched The Simpsons alternate ending of it, which was great. Captain Renault tries to shoot Rick in the back, and then Sam's on the piano on the tarmac at the airport. He says, "He's back in heat, Rick," and then shoves his piano at the captain and kills him. And then Isla comes out in a parachute. Oh, wait, then Hitler comes out of the top of the piano, and then Isla lands on it with a parachute and crushes Hitler. And then Rick says, "You know what to do, Sam." And then he starts playing a song, which is not the song from the movie. And then they cut to a wedding, and Sam's playing at
their
wedding.
That's so funny.
Classic.
Oh, also, I just remember this, Jonah. They referenced that scene in, remember Naked Gun? I think it's the second one, where he goes to the bar and he's all depressed. And the piano player comes by and he goes, "Play it, Sam. Play that song." And the guy goes,
"Oh, yeah.
Ding dong, the witch is dead." He's playing a song from...
"Play it, Sam. Play that song. Play our song, would you?" Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, he plays a song from Wizard of Oz.
"Ding dong, the witch is dead." But he goes like in the really high
pulse
setup.
Yeah.
That is like, I remember that scene so well. I love that scene.
So good.
We should do that movie. There's not really a lot of substance there, but it's good stuff.
Yeah, slapstick comedy unfortunately doesn't have a lot to dig into. It's just not true, because it's always referencing something else, right? The spoofs.
Exactly.
Yeah. Those guys really know their... It's like Family Guy. They have such a wide range of knowledge of film history, which is great.
Yeah, so much referencing.
Yeah.
They're all film buffs. Comedians.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's part of how we grow up, right? Like, it's become so much a part of our language, which is why we continually do this podcast.
Well, that's why I really enjoyed this film, because I know a lot of these lines, I know a lot of these scenes, I know a lot of these songs, and it's just kind of interesting to sit and absorb that and just appreciate it. And I mostly watched it like with a smile on my face. I was like, this is nice. This is a good movie. I'm enjoying this a lot.
Yeah. No, I was the same. Because I've seen it. It's one of my favorite films. I watch it every couple of years or so. But I was watching it because I was doing a play, and the girl in the play who was playing my wife, we got together and we had like a date night, And we watched that film because our play was set in 1952, so we decided that we definitely would have seen that film. So we watched it together. But I remember watching it, and Ingrid Bergman, man, how do you guys feel about her? Even though this is, pre-method acting, every time she was on screen, I thought she was insanely effective.
Yeah, she's really good.
Yeah, like
she's a great actress. Like, she really can. Mm-hmm. Show you her emotions.
Yeah.
Just with a close up. She's really good at it.
Yeah. I felt like every time she was on screen, especially in her close ups, she had this amazing innocence and vulnerability to her. And just her eyes were so active in mm-hmm. portraying like joy and everything like that. And I think, you know, obviously some of the more emotional scenes are a bit campy, but I thought she's really, really great.
I thought she was incredible as well. I also just liked, I liked her character a lot too. Like, she has this kind of this up and down arc where you perceive the situation differently, where she's like come in and she's like happily surprised to see Rick, not planning to have run into him. But then she also has this backstory. It's like, what did you do to Rick? Like, why did you treat him that way? And she seems to be kind of manipulative and deceptive in certain ways, trying to get what she wants. But ultimately, she really does care for Rick. And there's like this understandable dynamic that she always thought that her husband was dead, and then she fell in love with Rick, and then her husband came back. So she is just really loyal. Mm-hmm. And ended up in a situation that she never expected to be in, and did not know how to handle it. And then she leaves it to Rick, and he, because of the way his character has evolved over the film, he's able to make the right decision on their behalf, and she's able to respect that. So there's kind of this like really satisfying back and forth where it's like, I don't like her so much, and now I really like her, and now you like her again at the end. You love them both, and you're like, you get it. So, both great characters.
Yes.
So I wanted to ask you guys, because do you think that her motivation is real? Do you think that she really loves Rick, or do you think she's playing a game the whole time? Even at the end, do you think that...
I think she really loves Rick.
Yeah?
I think she doesn't love him.
You think she doesn't?
Yeah.
Please really?
Tell me. It's more like... I wouldn't call it love. I would say it's more like this
raw sexual energy.
Yeah.
Like, I think that's a fair analysis. There's an infatuation. I mean, they meet each other and then they kind of hit it off, but she obviously was not going, she was willing to not commit to him and also leave him. But at the same time, I think it's more for her is like the just the unknowns, which is understandable in the time frame that she had with Rick. She doesn't know how to, she would have liked to have seen where it went.
Well, it's
but she knows what's right.
But she does say that when she met Victor, she was innocent and very young. And he was this wonderful man. So there's that same sense of like idolizing this person.
Yeah.
Rather than loving him. So maybe maybe she actually does love Rick, and Rick is the love of her life, but recognizing again that what he says, like the problems of two people don't amount to a hill of beans in this world. So it's maybe her character is having the same revelation that the greater good is more important than what I individually desire.
I don't know. I think she doesn't love him.
I've always had that question because sometimes I think maybe it's a game, maybe it's a play to force Rick into the corner. I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know, like if she loved him really, I think the story would have gone a bit differently. But at the end she's really using him to get what she wants.
I think that's what she's like she's perceived to be doing, but she obviously, I think that Dan's observation is right.
It's really good
that it's that, well, she's clearly confused, but she has a different type of love for Rick than she does for Victor. And I think that both are genuine, and that's why she but she ultimately leaves it to him because she knows that what she's offering, because she does shift. She does go from like, I want to be with my husband to I want to be with Rick, and basically like send my husband on his merry way and we'll figure something out. I think she was committed to that ideal, but she knows it's not right and probably trusts Rick's character more to make the right decision. But she does she is surprised, but she also knows that Rick's decision's right in the end.
Yeah.
So I think she's at peace because of that.
Yeah.
Rick is a hero. Always.
All right. So this might be a little far, but I geeked out a little bit and I started looking at what the names mean. Because obviously film is a very intentional medium. So Victor means obviously conqueror. But he, Victor, serves as the ideal. So he's essentially a god, right? He's this kind of mythical figure. Ilsa, the name Ilsa means pledge to God. So she's married to the ideal. And then Richard means strong ruler, I think. So it's like this constant interplay between the names where like Rick becomes through his relationship with the ideal, he becomes what he is, the strong ruler again. And then Ilsa being pledged to God, you can see that that character is going to stay married to Victor. What do you think of that? That's pretty geeky, nerdy stuff.
I think it's good. Nice work, Dan. A+.
Thanks. You'll I really graduate. Appreciate the feedback.
You graduate from film school.
Yeah.
You pretentious.
Now go. Now go hold that microphone.
Yeah.
I'm just kidding.
Now you're a pretentious filmmaker.
Go sit by that door.
16 hours a day.
And sure, read a book.
Yeah.
What other beautiful notes you have for us, Dan?
Well, look, I think that's about it for me. I love the film.
I have to say it's now a film I love as well. Nice work, guys.
It's a beautiful film. Like, I've been really quiet. I've been thinking a lot about the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Just for the, since I'm going to still call it quarantine.
Sure.
Since the quarantine started, like, I've been watching a lot of classic movies. And I think it's something that we shouldn't, as a generation, to start forgetting about. Like,
yeah,
this movie is one of the most beautiful things we have in film history. There are so many other classic films that when you look at some of the newer films, you can tell they were inspired by them in the way they are shot. Like, I always bring Spielberg to the table, but when you see how Casablanca is shot, you can see a lot of how Spielberg works. Like, setting the whole, like a one shot and have multiple shots from that same shot.
Yeah.
It's pretty nice.
The blocking of the film is beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. That's a very good point.
Very good point. Like the camera movements, like one thing that happens a lot with, like you guys were talking about how before sound, like the image was everything. Like these directors who started working before the sound ever appeared in the movies, they paid a lot of attention of what they wanted to show you.
Yeah.
And they knew what was important. And it's something that we've been losing as every day goes by, because we are always like, oh, if we don't show it, then we can add it in post, or we can add some dialogue that mentions it. And they were so focused on showing what they wanted you to see at the right moment.
But there's also so much trust that's given to the audience to pick up these visual cues.
Yeah.
Which is also something we're losing. One of the shots that I absolutely loved, talking about beautifully composed shots, is when it's toward the first half of the film, when Rick goes to the safe and the camera tracks with them as they go up the stairs, and then it moves over and then Rick walks out of the frame and then you see his shadow projected on the wall from the light. Yeah. And then he walks back in. So that was just like, I love that shot because you're doing so much without actually building the set of the safe or whatever, you know?
I also think that that's kind of possibly symbolism of who he is. He's kind of a bit of a shadow of a man. He's a mystery. Yeah. He's a bit of a shell. Yeah. And
absolutely.
And there, it's actually quite a long scene, a long shot of him in that shadow shot.
Yeah.
And obviously very intentional.
Mm-hmm. I love watching movies that are actually shot on film because there's such an interesting quality to them. And the pacing is different. You're not cutting every 2 seconds, like, you know. I don't want to disparage them because I love them, but like a Marvel film, like this, the pacing of those films is so fast and the cutting is so fast, and they're really intentionally directing your eye and hoping and making sure you pick up on everything. But this film, it takes its time and it trusts you to get it.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's a beautiful thing about those films. That's why we need to appreciate them more. Everyone, love them and learn from them.
I was doing a bit of history on the director. This guy, I think he was a European director, Michael Curtiz, and he had done something like 78 films before he came to Hollywood and made this film. And then he went on and did a whole bunch of other work, but one that you might know, one of my favorites, Sean will know this as well, is he directed White Christmas with Bing Crosby.
Did he? Nice.
In 1954, yeah.
Wow.
I love that movie.
Great.
There's so many.
I've never seen it.
Oh, it's a great film.
I'm gonna watch it.
There's, could be our Christmas special.
We should do it as a Christmas special. It's old school, you know, Danny Kaye, Bing Crosby, just dancing and singing. It's just good, wholesome filmmaking. But well done. Well choreographed. Lots of great songs. Man. So nice.
Yeah, that's one of those films that I watch every year because it's actually like so insanely well done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's in Vista Vision. So cool.
Yes, it is Vista Vision.
Yeah, that's right. Good film.
I'm going to watch it.
So I think the last point that I have about this film is I think it's a Winston Churchill quote. It's the only thing necessary for evil to triumph is for good men to do nothing. And that essentially sums up this film. Because I think there's also a historical reference to this built into this movie in the attitude of America pre-World War II. Because they were very much like Rick, and they were isolationists, and they didn't believe in getting involved in the war. Mm-hmm. So there's that element to it, and then obviously they get launched into the war. And I think it's potentially speaking to that ideal. And the idea of changing your attitude and having to engage with the world rather than be alone in your isolated fantasy, essentially, you know, drowning in your own sorrow.
Well, they reference that in the film as well, right? They talk about how isolation just, there's one of the characters who says, isolation just isn't going to work anymore.
Yeah.
That's very early on, kind of calling out that, and it is true. Yeah, Rick kind of is the embodiment of America not being involved, stepping back. Even his cafe is an American cafe in the middle of obviously
a war zone.
Yeah, and doing nothing about it. Like he's kind of at this epicenter of, you know, tension, right?
Yeah,
people trying to get out.
And what would the result of his actions be at the end of the film, right? Where does that make sense? Like, once he decides to make that step, it has that triumphant end of like, oh, look what one person's actions can do. Look how much it can affect the world.
It can definitely. It has, you have this sense of hope that there is in Casablanca, this place of like no hope for many people, just waiting, this uncertainty. As soon as he does that, you kind of have this shift in like, this feels like it's going to work out, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was cool. there's a that like I said, I didn't know it was such a hopeful ending. I just always thought it was a very sad
romantic
film of a film of love lost, and that was it.
And at the end, it becomes like this buddy movie.
Yeah, this buddy cop film.
It's a buddy cop film.
Yeah, Casablanca too.
Yeah, Rick and Club Hitler.
He's the bad
Casablanca
cop.
This.
Yeah. He's the funny Rick cop who doesn't know that gambling's happening at the cafe.
And now.
Well, I mean, you could imagine what the sequel of that film would be, right? It would be, you know, 1942, so maybe it would have been, the next one would be Rick at Normandy or something like that.
Yeah.
I'm just glad that this film wasn't made in an era where successful films had to have a sequel. Thank goodness.
Oh, guys,
exactly.
I had that thought.
Go ahead.
Madonna was trying to do a remake of Casablanca.
Oh, dear God.
Yeah, like, everyone shut her down. Yeah.
Nobody needs to do that. These films don't need that. Go watch the original, please.
She wanted Ashton Kutcher to play Rick.
Oh my gosh. No.
Yeah.
There is, like, man, the ego. I tell you.
Okay, but here's an interesting idea. Why don't we hypothetically cast a modern day remake of Casablanca?
Okay, that's an interesting idea.
Okay, so who would we cast as Rick?
Who would you guess of the
actors today? Who do you think has that kind of quality?
Zac Efron.
Jason Momoa.
It's gonna be a real action-packed film if he's in it.
Yeah,
a lot of shirtless scenes.
Yeah. Oh, that's a good question.
Maybe we start with who would play Ilsa.
I would have Margot Robbie.
She's so overused, though.
I love her, though. She's so gorgeous.
Yeah, she's gorgeous. She's a great actress.
She is, actually. Yeah. I could almost see Scarlett Johansson doing it, too.
Oh, yeah.
She's a bit older, though.
And not just because she was in Jojo Rabbit, but yeah, that's true. She's a little bit older.
She's not 40
Margot Robbie
yet,
would be good. Yeah. She's got that range, but she's just... Maybe not the innocence that you're looking for, though. I don't know.
Yeah.
She does have a bit of an edge.
Yeah.
But I think she can play that. Like, when you see Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, she plays
this
sweet character.
That's true.
I really enjoyed that. Yeah, and I really liked her in that, too. Yeah, she just is kind of, like, going about town doing her thing. She's sweet.
She's not the girl from The Wolf of Wall Street.
No.
Oh, man.
I would say
we all fell in love with her there.
Yeah.
Yeah. The casting of Rick is definitely the hard one because he's a bit older and he's. Mm-hmm. Who can play an older? You know.
What about Hugh Jackman? Since we're casting Australian right
now. Yeah.
This could be an all-Australian cast.
Yeah.
And Chris Hemsworth
they
can be Victor. He actually could kind of work across the board, just like it. I do think Hugh Jackman would be great.
You might be able to flop that and go Hemsworth as Humphrey Bogart's character, and then Hugh Jackman as Victor Laszlo.
You know what? I was thinking Robert Downey Jr. could be a good Rick.
That's true.
Yeah. Yeah.
He plays a great jaded person.
Yeah. Like he knows how to play. Like he doesn't care about anything but himself.
Yeah.
He can make you feel it. Yeah. Well, he's like that, so it's not acting.
Yeah, Hugh Jackman. Well, Hugh Jackman in like The Prestige kind of has that vibe about him, right?
Yeah.
Where he's lost. Mm-hmm. That's a good example of him playing a Rick-like character.
Yeah, he's got
sort
that
of.
Intensity.
Yeah, he does have that. I'm really warming up to Hugh Jackman. And maybe you could have like these adamantium claws come out at some point. And he starts stabbing
I like that. That could be good.
So
you could make some money out of it.
Let's find a better Victor Laszlo then. It's gotta be
Billy Zane.
Billy Zane. What made you think of Billy Zane?
I don't know. I think about Billy Zane every once in a while. I liked him in Sniper a lot.
The first one was a good film.
Yeah.
Sniper, I always remember the scene where they're on the train and he's got like his like stretchy camouflage pants.
Yeah.
And then Tom Berenger takes, he like stretches it and shoots it out the window. He's like, hey, what are you doing? He's like, there's no room for Peter Pan on this trip, boy.
Sniper, so good. You know, who's oh, wait a minute, I think I've got our Victor. He kind of looks like him too. Hang on a second. Oh man, I don't know why.
Who?
Oh crap. Bradley Cooper.
Oh yeah.
He kind of has like even a similar like look to him. Look them up.
Yeah, he could be.
Like Bradley Cooper.
Give him a little eyebrow scar.
Yeah.
Yeah, he could do it.
Bradley Cooper and Paul.
I can see him doing
Henry.
It.
What about Jake Gyllenhaal for Rick?
He's a little too much boyish.
Yeah. I don't think so.
Okay.
I love him, but yeah. I don't know. Like, it's, have you seen Nocturnal Animals?
No.
No.
I saw Nightcrawler.
Watch Nocturnal Animals. Like, he has this heartbreaking performance in that film. But
he's,
I don't
great.
Know. Like,
I really like,
I always see him as this vulnerable guy.
Brad Pitt.
Okay.
Yeah. Brad Pitt.
Brad Pitt can almost
On, what's in the box?
Brad Pitt can play anything now.
Yeah, Brad Pitt.
I love Brad Pitt.
I've gone through phases with Brad, but like I always loved Brad.
Yeah.
What about Paul?
George Clooney.
George Clooney. Yeah, he could
I
be
love
a good.
George Clooney.
We'll
I
guess
almost
Brad
said Paul
and George.
Newman. Paul Newman.
We'll guess Brad and George is Victor and what's his name? Rick.
Jude Law could be Victor. I don't know. I always hate Jude Law.
Daniel Day-Lewis.
That guy could play anything.
He could play everyone.
Yeah. It'd be a one-man show.
Yeah, he plays every
like
single
Eddie
character.
Murphy.
In
like
the,
Eddie
yeah.
Murphy films.
That's right. Okay, now one more. The captain. Who plays the captain? Seth Rogen.
Michael Caine. The captain
who has that like level of charm and charisma that Claude Rains has.
I'd say I don't know, actually. I was gonna say Robert Downey Jr. maybe has more of that than a Rick character.
That's not a bad idea either.
I think we've been watching a lot of Marvel movies. We're only casting
Marvel. Hey, we got George and Brad in there.
I'd say Kevin Spacey, but he's no.
Everything would be like bad words.
Well, we'd have to we'd shoot it, and then we'd have to shut down and reshoot all his scenes.
Right.
Yeah.
Just for old time's sake.
Well, that's what they did with his last film, right?
Yeah.
They'd finished the shoot, and then they recast Christopher Plummer. I think it was a Ridley Scott film.
Oh, yeah. 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 Yeah, all the money in the world.
That's right. Yeah. So yeah, is that our new film? Is that our new film? We have George Clooney as Rick.
You know who could do it? Maybe is Christoph Waltz.
Oh,
Christoph Waltz could be the
that's
captain.
Brilliant, Jono. Christoph Waltz is Captain Reno.
Yeah.
I love
He's
it.
He's so lovable.
He's got a lot of charm, but like humor to him. Like, especially in Django Unchained, kind of this, like, he has a goodness, but he can be bad. He's he can kind of flip-flop back and forth really well.
Yeah.
That's great. That's
and
great
he's hilarious.
Casting. Yeah.
It's a bingo.
What a great scene. Okay, so we got Christoph Waltz as Captain Reno, Margot Robbie as Ilsa.
Yeah.
George Clooney as Rick, and Brad as Victor Laszlo.
Yeah, I like that. Let's just put George and Brad back together. It's Ocean's 14.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, there you go.
Or do we like
Hugh Jackman in there a bit better?
I like Hugh Jackman. I think he could be, like, because he has this, like, inherent goodness to him, but you can see, like, he's done a lot of roles where he's just been, like, he's been broken down into this horribly sad person, like, in The Fountain.
Did you see Prisoners? That's one of my favorite really films as well, and he's brilliant in that.
That was really good.
I need to watch that.
Yeah, it was the director from Sicario, Denis Villeneuve. He did the latest Blade Runner as well. It was shot by Roger Deakins, so it's just a stunningly beautiful film.
And he's doing Dune now.
Yeah.
We talked about that last time, actually. I expressed my excitement for that very much so.
I saw the pictures, and they looked like the Star Wars pictures from Episode 7. I didn't like them.
Oh.
But I'm excited for the film. I'm really excited for the film. Just didn't like the promos.
I haven't seen any stills from the shoot yet.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Look at them. They look like stills from Star Wars. Yeah.
You have to send them to me. I'm not too sure if I'd be looking at the right ones.
I'll send them to you.
Is it on Cinema Blend?
I don't know. Dune.
I like the logo they've got for it.
I mean, it looks cool, but
it's going to be a great film.
Yeah, I love that director. He's really good.
Casablanca. Who's playing Paul Atreid? Oh man, this looks cool. Wow. Anyways, okay. Casablanca. You do have some Star Wars actors in this as well. So
really,
what's his name? Poe is.
I don't know. Like,
what is
those
name for
those
a character?
Shots in
I
the
can't
desert?
Handle that.
Yeah,
Poe.
I think we all hate that.
Yeah. It's not Return to Star Wars.
No, that's not Return to Star Wars.
Yes.
After our hour and 45 minutes of just hating on it.
Yeah.
It's true.
But I think we made up for it by loving this film, didn't we?
Awesome.
Yeah.
So much love.
So, I mean, do we bother rating it?
Yes, we should.
I mean,
we should.
Okay, Alex, what do you give it?
10 out of 10.
Well, what else can you give?
It's perfect.
That's fair. That's really fair, Alex.
Yeah.
I'm in the. All right. So we got a perfect 30 out of 30.
It's a masterpiece.
It is. I really enjoyed
it. Yeah. And when you look at it alongside other films like what it came out the year before, 1941, Citizen Kane, which film do you prefer?
Casablanca.
Yeah, I think so as well. As brilliant as Citizen Kane is.
Yeah. Yeah, it's more my kind of movie than. I love Citizen Kane, but for me, this one resonates more with who I am.
As Captain Reno?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're just a romantic at heart. Or you love gambling, but you just, it does surprise you sometimes.
It surprises
when it's
you
there.
When you win. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. It feels more like a simple story, and I like that.
Yeah, it's. I mean, I don't want to say it's less of a character-driven piece because it's all character. Well, maybe it's more story than character-driven.
Yeah.
I don't know. Interesting. Great film. Yeah. Anyways, anything else to say or should we wrap this one up?
Go watch it.
Yeah.
And watch old movies.
Yeah, I hope like after listening to this, if anyone is out there thinking about these kind of films, like do a bit of research on them and look at the intentionality of it and the brilliant way in which these directors use the medium of, you know, the visual medium and storytelling to really enhance what's going on underneath the story. Like the form and the content, it all blends so well. And the intentionality of the production design and the skillfulness of the writing, these films have so much to offer. So anyways, we hope that's been enlightening for you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Please watch more movies like this.
All right. And we'll, any ideas for next week or should
Citizen
we just
Kane?
Leave them in suspense.
We could do Citizen Kane or some Hitchcock movie. I mean, he's the master of suspense.
Do we have anything to contribute to Citizen Kane? I feel like it's been talked to death.
Yeah.
Don't you think right. Casablanca has been talked to death?
Nah.
Not so much as Citizen Kane.
Yeah, like when you go to film school, like all the teachers, the only movie they talk about is Citizen Kane and how important it is. Casablanca is just barely mentioned.
No.
Yeah. Maybe it's sort of that Pulp Fiction versus Forrest Gump thing.
We could do On the Waterfront.
Oh, I haven't seen that in years.
And that would be a nice way to jump off into the introduction of method acting as well.
Yeah. I like doing these classic films, actually. I haven't seen On the Waterfront. I think I watched it with you, Dan, years ago.
Yeah. Well, that was probably during mine and Tom's Marlon Brando phase.
It was, yeah, lots of Marlon Brando going on.
Yeah, but again, like, that's a good idea. I'd love to do that film because I haven't seen it in probably 15 years.
Yeah, I haven't seen it like in 10 years. Let's do it.
Okay, great.
Great movie.
Okay, well, next week we'll be back with On the Waterfront. Hope you're enjoying our classic streak, and we'll see you next week.
Yeah.
So long.
Okay, people. So long. Bye-bye.